Well, we're in James, and we're going to verse 12, chapter 1, verse 12. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. And when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, so that we would be a kind of first fruits among his creatures. Well, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. Well, I was reading a Calvin and Hobbes last week, and Calvin was making a big snowman, or a big snowball, rolled up this big ball. Hobbes is asking what he's doing. He said, I'm making a monument to the triumph of perseverance. And Hobbes says, well, how big are you going to make this? And Calvin said, I'm bored. Perseverance. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. Persevere, remain instead of fleeing. Stand one's ground, hold out, endure in trouble, affliction, persecution. That's what the basic or the standard Greek dictionary has it. Remain instead of fleeing. Stand firm. Stand one's ground. So blessed is the man who remains. He doesn't flee from the trial. Remain. Blessed is the man who stands his ground during a trial. Blessed is the man who endures even in the trouble or the affliction of it. For once he has been approved. Approved by a test, that's what it's looking at. You know, the tried and true, the genuine. You know, there's you know, it could be in the sense of approved after a test as gold or silver is. I mean, yeah. You know, there's that sense of, you know, being tried and true, meaning it's genuine, that it's pure. I don't know if gold is ever, you know, I don't know much about those kind of metals, but I don't think they're ever in that sense absolutely pure, but you get the impurities out to a certain degree, and that's, you know, we're looking at this purity. But this sense of you know, who perseveres not, for he has been approved, is that, you know, there's that positive sense of tested for the purpose of approval, not you know, trying to defeat it, but it's a tried and true, it's, you know, it stood the test, it's achieved that sense. It says he will receive the crown of life. Which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Hi, Leslie. We're in James 1:12. You know, this is probably, you know, trying a lot here. Probably is just a reference to, I say, just. I mean, you know, just. I mean, it. You know what we might say elsewhere. You know, eternal life, or that sense. Though we shouldn't. You know, these are some of the places that. You know, you have. In James, where you have to be careful not. Reading in Paul's theology in James, and then therefore having this conflict that's not necessarily
there, you know, not reading into this, that this means that one gains salvation, you know, through this means. It's not necessarily, you know, putting it that way, but it is, you know, because it's also, it says, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. So, even in the context, you know, blessed is the man who perseveres in trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life. Yet, the crown of life is already stated, which the Lord promised to those who love him. So, the ones that get the crown of life are those who love him, but in this case, it's the other. So, it's, you know, if you try to look at this sentence and say, well, this is why you get the crown of life, there's even two reasons given in this one sentence. The crown of life is promised to those who love the Lord, yet the crown of life is being awarded or given here because people persevere. So I think if we try to read into it or to use this as a you know, a stepping stone to say this is how one gains salvation, then it's going against what this passage is about. The passage isn't saying this is how you become saved, this is how you get the crown of life. Rather, it's this positive reward that's being stated. It's the association is blessed is the man who does this, and then it says, you know, here are these things that are added to it that, you know, that come along because of it, not looking at the other to say this is how you get there. And, you know, you can't take everything and say, well, you know, there's a cause-effective relationship that this was the outcome, therefore that was the cause. The passage is clearly not saying that because it wasn't designed and it wasn't promised to those who earned it. It was promised to those who love Christ. And love would be a hard one to attribute merit to. But the focus here is blessed is the man who perseveres. So we can go back to the sense of early on when it says, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Here it's saying that the man who endures those, the man who stands under it, it's almost, you could almost picture here that there's this weight or this thing under it, if you use that one definition where it says remain instead of fleeing, that this thing is under me and I'm not running away from it. Doesn't mean one would always be under a trial, because the trial might leave, or there, you know, the Lord might lead you to step out in a certain way, but you're not fleeing from it because it, you know, just I don't want trials, I'm running away from them. But here it's that positive sense that when one endures them, which goes back to exactly what it began with, you know, consider it all my joy. Here's another reason why you would consider it all joy, because you're actually blessed by God. This is a blessed position to be in, which, you know, isn't something you're going to come about naturally. You know, you get some statements that are made at times from people. There's this back from Oregon, I don't know what his name is, the guy that hit the Boise State player and was suspended for the rest of the year, and depends how you want to read into that or read it, but there's some mentors who have been very impressed with him, the way he's reacted to things, and so there's, you know, some encouragement of him to coming back. Well, he wrote this letter of apology, you know, which you can debate whether he actually wrote it or not, as some do, but in it, he talks about, he says something about, I forget how it's worded, but, you know, through this, you know, I, you know, am a better man or something, you know, having dealt with that. Well, biblically, there's a sense that that's true. Now, what we have to be careful of as individuals is that when we cause something, when we're in a trial because of our wrong actions, you know, to quickly say, you know, to cite this verse, you know, consider it all joy, it's kind of missing the point. Though the principle would still be there at that point, but you can't hardly go back to why I'm in the trial. So the guy could, you know, from a biblical standpoint, you could say, well, at this point, given this situation, if he responds correctly, he will be a better man. That's not to imply that going through the trial, the only way you got in the trial was by doing something wrong. Therefore, that was a good path to take. And sometimes it almost gets marred as though, oh, this was a good thing that happened to me because look what I've grown. Well, no. If you hadn't done it, you wouldn't have needed to grow in that area, you know. So,
but there is that sense for, you know, so I mean, I don't think you can read these, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial.
You know, blessed am I because I caused myself to be in a trial. But yet, once you're in that trial, here's the man that perseveres and it remains in the seat of fleeing, the one that dealt, you know, however appropriately, if that's to talk about it, then the passage does talk about that. He goes on, he says in verse 13, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. Well, it's kind of difficult here. I mean, what's the difference between trials and temptations? We usually, you know, by our terminology, there's big differences. But is that necessarily true biblically? But I think by interpretation of the words here, there is a difference. I think we can look at temptations or as trials as objectives, as an objective external. I mean, we can look at it and say it's a trial. That's not to say there aren't trials that, you know, aren't internal. But for the most part, the internal thing is something objective. I mean, you're dealing with something objective. Whereas temptation becomes an subjective internal. Not to say that the temptation isn't physical, but yet the physical really isn't the temptation. It's the internal that becomes the temptation. And so he says here, temptations do not come from God. One writer says, because of a wrong inner reaction, the testing that God meant for our good may become an occasion for sin. The shift in meaning from the objective to the subjective aspect is clear from the contents of this paragraph. Well, that didn't mean much, but because of our wrong reaction, you know, that's kind of interesting. Then one situation could be good depending on how you respond, but yet it could be bad the other one. It's that's one of the things I have trouble with the some of the forgiveness issues, is that the need for forgiveness often, or the need for apologies in our society, often is based upon somebody's reaction. If you go back to the Boise State, Oregon, I guess it was a five, but the punch. You mean there were things that happened before the game, and this guy had already had problems, but the very close, you know, element of when it happened, the Boise State player was saying something. Exactly how much he was taunting or what he was saying, it was unlikely he was saying good game.
Give him
the coach's reaction. Probably wasn't saying good game. You know, he did something, and let's say the Oregon player walks off the field. Well, the coach grabbed the guy. What would the coach have done? I don't know. You know, obviously, we don't know what he would have done. But he wasn't happy with him. He would have said something then. Would there have been further discipline? I don't know. Maybe not. But it would have never, nobody would have known about it. Whatever the coach was going to do would have been sufficient. But when the guy hit him, then everything was about the guy that got hit. Until that guy got suspended for the year. And when he got suspended for the year, the question became, well, what's going to happen to the guy that taunted? You see, nobody would have been concerned about the taunting except for the reaction. And, you know, to me, I mean, it's like, wait a minute. You know, we ought to be able to look at those isolated. Like, his reaction doesn't make this better or worse. So whatever it was is what it was. But our society doesn't work that way. It's the reaction that makes something. You know, even our criminal system now is evidently so much of it is based upon as far as the punishment or, you know, whatever it is, what's the appropriate terms, which is always weird, you know. Texas is the Department of Corrections, you know. I don't know what Oklahoma uses the same word or what, but it's not. Is there any effort to correct anybody? But anyway, the you know, victims and victims' families now appear in court to say how much this has affected them. And I'm like, that is so bad, in my opinion. I thought it was that they broke a law. That in and of itself should cure whatever. No, not because I'm there and saying, oh, this has affected my life so much. I mean, what if I, you know, from a from a Christian standpoint, and I'm not trying to say all of us would be there, but from an ideal, which never represent this idea, ideal standpoint, the Christians show up and saying, well, yeah, that, you know, it's really affected my life. I mean, you know, he killed my wife and da-da-da, but, you know, through God and through Christ, you know, who strengthened us, we're getting along fine, and we did da-da. Okay, the guy can go free. The heathen comes in and says, my life's falling apart, and the next guy goes to jail forever. I mean, that makes no sense to me. But anyway, that's a long ways off from this. But the point being that, you know, how do we, you know, once we're there, how do we persevere? And then so the other one is, how do we react? So there's a guy that's, you know, on the radio once I heard, was talking about, somebody say, I won the lottery, you know, that, you know, it's a blessing from God. And he goes, how do you know it's a blessing from God? Do you wait and see how you deal with it? How do you know it's a blessing? And that becomes that. I mean, you know, when something is placed in front of you, God, theoretically, you know, from our perspective, could have meant it for good, but because of your selfishness, it becomes evil. And, you know, a lot of people that win the lottery, it apparently doesn't become a good thing for them. And but here the focus is, you know, opposed to this external trial, there's this internal thing. But when you're being tempted, it's, you know, it says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. This carried away is, it would be like if you tied a rope to something and you pulled it away. If you tied a, you know, put a chain on one car and a chain on another car and towed it, you know. That's what's in view. You're being towed away. One time my parents had a, had this automatic, and only John will probably know this, you know. Eva might remember it. She probably, they probably wouldn't remember it if it happened, but there were a few, and I'm not sure too many people did this. Dodge did some of these. They made push-button automatics. And my mother was, the car broke down. My dad was a mechanic for school, and so he went out and got it, and so he's towing her back to town, and that where you wouldn't, you know, a normal transmission, you'd get it out of gear pretty easy. Well, this thing, it wasn't observed that it's in gear or whatever, you know. And so the fuel pump keeps turning the way that one was set up. Anyway, the car catches on fire. Well, Daddy's driving along there, you know, and Mom's back there in the car, and smoke's coming out, and, you know, she can't get Daddy's attention. Well, that's this passage. You're being drug away. You're being towed away. And that might be an appropriate analogy. All of a sudden, now the car's on fire and you're being towed away. Somehow, Mom got Dad's attention. She didn't burn up. I don't think it did the car any good, though. But that's the idea here. You're being carried, drug away. Enticed. This is a technical term by, of that time period, fishermen. You entice something. You know, it's to draw out. So this combination of terms here is to draw something out and entice it. So you can imagine that's the whole idea of a lure. You know, you're trying to entice. And so so when you're tempted, you know, it's not by God, but what actually is happening when you're tempted is you're carried away. You're enticed. But it's by your own lust. Lost in Scripture is a word that's, the word can be neutral, as opposed to in English, lost is, I don't think lust is ever used in a positive way. You know, lust is a negative term in English, and it often carries, you know, sexual connotations. The Greek word for lust, or that's translated lust here, the word is a neutral word. It can be positive in some settings, and in other things, it's negative. So positive, you know, you're talking about you desire something. Negative, you're lost. But lust isn't, you know, it doesn't have a sexual connotation unless the context has one in Scripture. But it means to desire, long, to crave. And obviously in this setting is a negative context. So when one is, when you're desiring something so much, it carries you away, it entices you, you know, from a negative standpoint. Then when lust has conceived, it's almost in a sense when it's grasped, you know, when it seized you, when it's apprehended. So that would be the concept of conceive here. When it's latched onto you, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. So that idea of when it's accomplished would be when it's brought to completion, and I don't know, death here is probably, you know, shouldn't be equated with, like spiritual death, but more in the sense of that it's, you know, the association, the figurative sense that would be associated with death is, you know, undefined terror, you know, it's the, you know, so it ends up being intended to cover every form of distinction and final collapse to which man is heir. You know, it's this, it has a more of a spiritual, obviously, nature to it than physical, because we're not talking about physical death. But it's that sense of defeat or finality that would be there with death. And it's kind of interesting, even in its wording, because it, you know, it brings forth, it gives birth, you know, when it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth, which is another kind of a figurative use about bringing, giving birth, but now the birth is death. You know, it's not the positive. And so he moves from there and he says, "Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren." It's kind of a changing directions here. And the idea for deceived is, do not go astray. Do not be misled. Do not wander away. Seems to, you know, make this hinge, because he's talking about sin leads to death. Sin, you know, temptation, you know, comes about when our lusts take over and it gives birth to sin, and then sin leads to death. And he says, but do not be deceived. Not so much don't be deceived by sin, which is, an appropriate place in Scripture. But here's, you know, don't be deceived by all this, because every good thing given and every perfect gift from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting of shadow. There, you know, God is always consistent, and the good things are from God. So we're looking at this evil in the previous verses, but instead of evil, you know, God doesn't give the temptation. You know, it's not God. God's not out there saying, "Okay, let me see if I can get you to goop up." Gotcha. But God gives good things, and it's, you know, God is about giving the good. And so it gives this positive positive aspect, bring back into almost balance of these passages as it hinges back. You know, God doesn't do this. Hey, but this is what God does. God doesn't put the evil before you, but God does put the good things before you. And he has a purpose. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, purpose so that we would be a kind of first fruits among his creatures. And so, God has a purpose of being good to us, and it's to put us in that position to be, you know, to produce fruits, to be fruit. So there's this positive as well as the negative. So apparently, because James is saying this, we assume that some were at that point of saying, you know, I don't know if they're saying God caused us to sin, but apparently at least they were saying God's putting those things in front of us, to see if we pass the test. But it's, you know, and even that sense of passing tests, you can test things with the purpose of that it would fail, or your goal, your purpose in testing it is to, you know, approve it. So it seems like some were seeing this as negative from God, and James is saying, no, that's not it at all. The temptation is from you, but look what comes from God, the good gifts. Do you have thoughts or insights? Well, yeah, it's kind of, you know, it says you're tempted when you're enticed by your own lust, but it never says what temptation in that regard, you know. It seems to be, though, I mean, it's hard not to think that certain things aren't, that the temptation isn't, you know, and at least in some cases, external. And I think you could make some arguments from other passages, but I think when James, though, you know, if we're just in this passage, the temptation is, you know, internally. The temptation is when you focus on whatever that is in a wrong way. So James is putting it all back on us. Now, having said that, you know, Paul talks about the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the, you know, sinful world, and talks about Satan, going around this with flaming darts. So I don't know that biblically we would say that's an absolute. That, you know, in this passage, because I think, you know, when we're reading James, it's in contrast to God. It's not this, you know, he's not doing a treatise on temptation. And so I think, you know, as we look at Paul, we would see temptation or those things broader than that, that they're more objective, they're out there, or that Satan can induce them to us. There's almost that thing of the arrows, you know, flaming arrows coming in our minds, and you got that thought, and it's kind of like, that's really not my thought, that's, you know, and then how do you deal with it? For me, biblically, from a broader biblical standpoint, you know, I would say, well, one, clearer from this passage, that temptation comes internally. Temptation can come from Satan implanting that. Temptation comes from a fallen world. And so there are at least three aspects. But ultimately, it does come back to how do you react to it. And that'd be the whole thing in Ephesians 6. I mean, are you going to react to it with a shield faith to extinguish those darts? Are you going to? But so I mean, in some degree, it comes back to that.
But doesn't it say somewhere too that the flesh wars against?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you have the whole thing of, you know, in Romans and somewhat in Ephesians too, that we're, you know, with our fallen, well, if you want to call it fallen sin nature or fallen, sinful disposition, that there's always an element within us that we're at odds with God. You know, there's that part in us that has a hard time aligning with God, and then there's this new nature that has this relationship with God, and it's, to some degree, it's not like there's this battle going on in us of which one's in control. But it's sometimes of which one do we choose to, you know, have that exercise. So, but there is that, you know, as we give way. But I mean, I think experientially, we would say that certain things are objectively, there's objective temptations.
Well, yeah, because you could even say something might be a temptation to John that wouldn't be a temptation to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to have to be somewhat personalized and
right.
Based on.
Yeah. But even without that, yes. But even, you know, if you individually, you say, okay, there are those things that are objective temptations. I mean, we could go, you know, somewhat down. There's casinos around. There's, without saying that gambling, quote, is a sin, there's still that nature we know that's there. There's, you know, various things that become seductive in various ways that it's designed for that purpose. That's, you know, exactly, you know, the subtle messages, you know, we're always being told we deserve stuff and various things like that put us in that realm. But at some point, you know, it's like Jesus was saying, you know, I mean, it, you know, definitely a paraphrase here, but it's, you know, it's not those, not the crafty billboard message that you see is the problem that's coming in. It's what's going out that's the issue. And so it's a hard one to define in that sense. What is a temptation? You know, because when you define it, you end up making temptation external. But James would say a temptation becomes your response that breeds this that ultimately puts in a debt. And but I think we'd be foolish not to at least associate with it objective things, and then recognizing where we are, say, okay, you know, those are the things that are tempting to me, and I have to be, you know, vigilant about.
Any of them, we find that we have what it takes to confirm the temptation.
Yeah, I mean, the Corinthians passage talks about being placed in that. And of course, this passage is positive. I mean, we, you know, we get focused on certain things. When you look at the passage overall, the passage is positive. Then it starts off, it says, blessed is the man who perseveres. So it talks about that we're blessed. Then it says, let no one say when he's tempted, God is, you know, that God's doing it. God doesn't tempt. Okay, so there's another positive. God doesn't tempt. But he explains temptation. Temptation is when we're carried away. And so there's some negative thing there, but we've got the clarification. God's not doing it. It's when we're carried away. And don't get confused on this. God gives good things. And the good things you have are from God. So, you know, overall, this is a real positive passage, though the part that is about temptation is so clear. It's very penetrating, and it catches our attention. Which is, you know, kind of gets interesting. Anything else?
Any prayer requests?